Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Well, I wonder, Wendy, do you keep a diary? Lots of people do. I mean, often it's an intermittent thing, an activity that you come back to at different points in your life and practice religiously before forgetting about it again, perhaps for months or even years at a time. Lots of us begin diaries and don't go on with them. For others, though, diary keeping is a lifelong commitment. It becomes a place where you can be your most honest, a repository for your innermost thoughts and reflections on your life and the world around you. Which is why there's nothing quite like reading someone else's. History is full of amazing diaries and diary keepers, and tonight we're going to explore some of the most interesting and significant examples. From diaries that give you a front row seat to world-changing events, to others that simply offer a candid glimpse into the private thoughts and moments of otherwise ordinary people. And I'd love to hear from you tonight. If there's a diary that's made a big impression on you, give us a call. Maybe you're a diary keeper too. You can tell me why. Joining us tonight from Scotland, all the way across the world, is Alan Taylor. Alan's a journalist and he's also editor of a wonderful book called The Assassin's Cloak, an anthology of the world's greatest diarists. If you're after a Christmas present, by the way, I could recommend it. It's now been in print for over two decades, and Alan joins us on the program tonight. Alan, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Thanks for asking me, Phil. It's very nice to be talking to you all this distance away.
I know, and here you are coming in loud and clear from the remote district. Well, you're not even in the big cities in Scotland, are you?
Certainly not, no.
No.
we're very remote, yeah.
Anyway, whatever they're doing on digital lines there, keep focused on it because you're sounding loud and clear.
Yes.
Also focusing tonight on a few of the diaries held in Australian collections is Greg Durand, a senior librarian for Victorian and Australian collections at the State Library in Victoria. Greg, thanks for joining us as well and welcome to Nightlife.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us, both of you. Alan, 20 years is a pretty long time for a book to be continually in print, particularly an anthology. There's a lot of interest in reading other people's diaries, isn't it? Because why do you think it is? Is it because of the seemingly illicit nature of it? You think we're getting a look at something that wasn't intended to be published?
Yeah, I think it is partly that. I think that people feel that they're at the keyhole of other people's lives and they are sort of dipping into something they really shouldn't be dipping into. Of course, a lot of the diarists that were included in the Assassin's Cloak had agreed for their books to be published, their diaries to be published, so they could hardly complain when people read them. But when you open a diary, you suddenly feel that you're sort of in direct contact with the diarist. And I think that gives them a sort of special appeal, more appealing, for example, say, than an autobiography or a memoir where a writer has a lot of control over what they're actually writing. Mm. Of course, they have control over what they're doing in their diary, but they're doing it day to day. So they're in a bit more of a hurry. They don't have time to consider what they're doing. They just write it down. And so suddenly you open the pages and you're there with them going through that day, going through that life.
Yeah, exactly. Do you keep a diary?
Well, I have, as you said in the introduction, Phil, kept diary intermittently, like a lot of other people. And then I just gave up. I was too self-conscious. But I did keep did write a diary for a long time for various Scottish newspapers. And that got me into a lot of trouble because I had an editor who liked to sort of highlight in bold print the names of the people I was talking about in the diaries. And some of these people didn't like to be mentioned, but it became a kind of compulsion. And I just threw names in for the sake of it, because I knew that they would see their names pop out of the newspaper in bold print. And they say, oh, what's being said about me?
Mm.
And so that was fun to write. But I in writing that diary, I kind of adopted a persona. It wasn't really me. It was me as a journalist writing a diary.
Mm. Yes, yeah, yes, exactly. The fascination, I suppose, with other people's lives and thoughts is understandable, but what do you think it is that drives people to write a diary for themselves? Is it confessional? Is it therapy? What is it?
Well, both of those things, partly, for some. Others, it's a determination, a desire to record something that they feel that this is the way they can make a mark on the world. This is how they can sort of rise above the crowd. They might be living through tumultuous events, or tumultuous events may be happening to them, you know, things domestic, family, love affairs, great sporting events, you name it. Something can be happening to them and they feel that they need to write it down. I don't think a lot of them immediately go into it thinking other people are going to read it. They just want to say something. They want to say, well, I feel there's a need to say something. The great Renaissance autobiographer and silversmith Benvenuto Cellini said that when a man reached the age of 40 and had achieved something in life, it was incumbent upon him to write an autobiography. And I think a lot of people feel that about diaries, that when they've got to a certain point in their life, they think, well, what is this life for? Well, I'll write it down and see if I can make some kind of sense of it. And then, of course, as you also intimated earlier, people give up. They don't sustain it for whatever reason. Quite a lot of the time it's because they think this is worthless. Why am I writing this diary? But others continue to write it because the diary becomes a sort of daily confessional, an opportunity to sort of spill out their thoughts in a way that they can't even to their nearest and dearest. Mm. And suddenly the diary becomes addictive. They keep returning to it day after day after day. And when they don't do that, when they miss a few days, they feel guilty. They feel they're being unfaithful. They're spending their time doing something else when they should be writing about their diary, mm. writing in their diary. And diarists, the great diarists' diaries are full of reproach to themselves for saying, well, I'm sorry, I haven't written in the diary for several days. Please forgive me.
Is it a particularly English thing, do you think, Alan? I mean English in the sense of English-speaking people's thing, not the country of England so much. But do you think it's culturally more common in English than, or does it exist in all cultures?
I think it does exist in all cultures. Now, you know, I wish I could speak for all cultures, but I think the evidence shows that, you know, there is a desire across humanity to make a record and to keep a record. But for some reason, it does seem to be particularly popular amongst English speakers. You know, and I include the whole of the Commonwealth, America.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I've thought quite long and hard about it. And I think one of the reasons is that the great diarist, the greatest of the great diarists, is Samuel Pepys, who was writing in the 17th century and living in the 17th century. And he was a fairly remarkable man because he rose quite high in the Admiralty, but also he was very interested in what was happening domestically. But he had no intention, it seems, of publishing his diary. And he partly wrote the diary in a sort of strange kind of French-like language from time to time when he wanted to hide things from his wife in case she came across his diary. But after he died, the diary, he was going blind, by the way, and so he gave up writing the diary. The diary just disappeared after he died. It hadn't been published and it just disappeared. And then it was published in the 19th century and it became a phenomenal success. And I think that's what happens. Something becomes a phenomenal success and other people say, aha, I've read Pepys's diary and that looks quite easy to do. Look, the guy's just writing day by day. I can write day by day. And I think a lot of people then took up diary keeping, encouraged by the popularity of Pepys's diary, which is a fantastic diary.
Mind you, he reveals himself as a person who probably wouldn't go down too well in the Me Too era. This is his.
Oh, no.
This is Samuel Pepys's entry from the 1st of December. That's today here in Australia.
Yes, yes.
The 1st of December, 1660. Samuel Pepys. This morning, observing some things to be laid up not as they should be by the girl, I took a broom and basted her till she cried extremely, which made me vexed, but before I went out, I left her appeased.
Yes.
So, terrific. Yeah, I mean, so after a short bout of domestic violence, he's on his way. But it's that level of domesticity too, which is attractive about Pepys, isn't it? Apart from the other things, we'll talk some more about him in a moment. But
yeah, it's exactly that. And you know, the thing is that the age of Me Too and PC-ness and all the rest of it, you have to put that to one side when you read diaries going back. You have to sort of enter into the kind of spirit of the age in which the diarist is living.
Of course.
At the same time, you have to realize that, you know, when you include, as they are in the book, diarists like Joseph Goebbels and things like this, they're going to say pretty unpleasant things and things that will make you want to scream and shout at them. But it does illuminate who they were and what they were about.
Yeah, it sure does. It's a fascinating collection. Greg, can we bring you in here? Does Australia have a particularly strong history when it comes to diarists? I was putting that question to Alan saying, you know, diary keeping seems to be more common in the English-speaking cultures. What's been the case here in Australia? There are plenty of people have been in remote parts of Australia for long periods of time and have had plenty of time to put their thoughts together. What's the tradition of diary keeping in Australia?
Well, from the settler colonial perspective, many of those diaries and diarists were they're already keeping diaries on their way here. There's a huge amount of material that are known as shipboard journals and shipboard diaries that maybe someone wasn't necessarily a diarist before they left the UK, but they would keep a diary on the way. And, you know, there's not a lot to do on a slow ship out to the colonies. And so we have quite a lot of information about those trips. But then we do have also a lot of people who kept diaries going afterwards. One that immediately comes to mind for me is a Welsh diarist called Joseph Jenkins, and he kept his diary going for 58 years. And he started in 1839, but he didn't actually come to Australia until 1869. He arrived here in his 50s, which is in itself a really unique perspective. But he was, as Alan talks about in his book, in the difference between diaries and journals, which is, you know, fluid, but the one way to think about it is a diary is every single day, if you can, and a journal is as things happen, as you find time to do it, as significant events occur. And Jenkins was an everyday man, mostly in English, but also in Welsh, more often in Welsh in times of anguish or of poetry, because he wrote poetry and he won quite a few awards at the, I think it was the Ballarat Ice Deadford. Mm-hmm. But his diary was so important to him that when he couldn't get a book, he's sometimes referred to as the swagman. He certainly had a lot of different jobs when he was here. If he couldn't buy one, he'd make one. And in moments of extremis in the 1890s, 1890 itself, when the Russian flu hit Australia or the colonies, he was writing through 6 weeks of this disease, thinking he was going to die. And one of his thoughts that he wrote was, "It appears now that my diaries will never go to Wales," which he always had his thought they had to go back. He did get better and he eventually did go back. I'm not entirely sure of his reception because the diaries are split between here and Wales. We only have the ones from his Australian life, but he did leave his family with little to no notice and then arrived with little to no notice when he was in his 70s.
You're right, but what Jenkins does is provide a window, doesn't he? I mean, it's like a direct report from colonial Australia about the ordinary passage of events. I mean, he writes about the price of cabbages, for example. I mean, he writes about Aboriginal land rights, which he thinks is probably a good thing. He writes about all. I mean, we often decide to impose our own beliefs about what people thought. These are direct windows, aren't they?
Particularly with diarists like Jenkins, who are determined to capture everything about what they are doing. When you say, why do people keep diaries? I think he kept it for every possible reason. He kept track of his money that he earned, his hours worked. He kept track of his thoughts about other people. And it was also a therapeutic diary for himself. He had some darkness in him that no one's really sure exactly why. He does write in an entry, I think, in one of the Welsh diaries about him experiencing domestic violence, being subject to it, but they're not, people are not sure if that's why he left Wales. And he does talk about where a lot about how he was not an educated man and how much his life would have been different if he had been educated. He returns to themes over and over again, but just the strength of his opinions is also important because you learn so much about farming practices in Victoria just by how judgmental he was of other farmers.
Alan, can we go back to Samuel Pepys? Because he's often regarded, as I say, as the first real diarist. And lots of people, as you say, when they read his diaries, copied him. He provided unique access and windows into history because he rose to be quite a senior person. He was Chief Secretary of the Admiralty under both King Charles II and King James II. So he was a fly on the wall at historic events, and that made it important, wasn't he? Although he also wrote about things, he wrote about all sorts of things. I love the entry about the venison pasty. Do you recall that one?
Yes, I do. I mean, the thing is that this is what makes Pepys such a great diarist, I think, Phil, that he sort of moves. We tend to forget when we see people on the world stage that they have a private domestic life beyond what they're actually doing in public. And suddenly with somebody like Pepys, you get this fantastic picture of what is happening in his house, his desires, his kind of cares about money, about his relationships with his wife. And then the next minute, he's inside great affairs of state. He's witnessing great events, great fires, tumultuous revolutions, all the rest of it. And he writes so brilliantly. I think this is an English thing, not an English-speaking thing, insofar as I think the English of a certain class have a certain sense of themselves. They're not afraid to state their opinions, even to themselves. And Pepys is extraordinarily candid in that respect. And he seems to
a bit full of himself, I think you're saying, Alan.
He's totally full of himself. Yeah. He comes across as a rather sort of pompous personality. Mm. But nevertheless, you think because of that, he tells you more than most people would think is sensible.
Because he thinks his opinion's worth telling.
Yes. And you can see this all the way through. You quoted his entry from the 1st of December. Mm. But the last entry on the 1st of December, which I've just looked at, I think is by Alan Clark, a conservative politician in the Thatcher era. And Alan Clark was known for his kind of licentious behaviour, his attitudes towards women. He was a heavy drinker and all the rest of it. And he was like Pepys too. He was inside Parliament. He witnessed great events. He was an admirer of Margaret Thatcher and a bit of a roué and a snob, an incredible snob. He was the man who said of Michael Heseltine, you know, he wasn't a proper gentleman because he had to buy his own furniture. he hadn't inherited it. You think, well, yeah, okay. And so people actually despise the man but love the diarist.
Yes. As Alan Clark says, there was a French admiral sitting next to me, his face expressionless. I said, it helps one to understand how women can experience 10 or 11 orgasms in one night. Myself, yes. Three render me complètement. Totalement. Et puis, ruefully, he agreed. That's right.
Yeah.
Was he real?
Watching a belly dancer.
That's right. They were watching a belly dancer. Did Alan Clark care that this would ever be published, or did he think that's fine?
Oh, no, I'm sure I'm definitely sure he wanted his diaries published. I mean, he hit the headlines for a while because of his kind of infidelities, and his wife stuck by him in the true Tory wife fashion. But it wasn't just ordinary infidelities. He was having affairs with sisters, for example. And he writes about all of this in the diaries. He writes about how hard up he is, despite the fact he's a millionaire living on a huge estate. But then he's very kind of sentimental about wildlife, which is also a very English thing. And so he cries at the killing of a bird, that kind of thing. And I think that the Alan Clarks of the world still exist. They still are in Parliament, believe it or not, and they still have a lot of these attitudes. And they still have a belief that, you know, we all will want to read their diaries because this is their say of a particular time. I mean, the diary of the last year or so has been the unexpurgated diaries of a character called Chips Channon, who is included in the Assassin's Cloak. But now we have his completely unexpurgated diaries. And if they had been published, I think, in the 1950s, they would have brought about a revolution, the end of the monarchy and the establishment in London.
We've only been talking about men here, Greg. Women wrote diaries too, and particularly in Australia, one of the historical diaries of great interest was Anne Drysdale. Tell me about hers.
Yes, so we have it's several diaries that Anne Drysdale kept as a squatter from about the early 1840s with her partner, Caroline Newcomb. Mm-hmm. Now, exactly what that partnership was is not clear from the diary, but they lived together for over 10 years. The diaries are detailed, but they don't keep the sort of details in them that people would need to work out exactly the intimate details of their relationship. So it's almost working from what's not there to try and work out what their lives were. But it's not just their relationship which makes these diaries important, because they're starting their farm very early in the colony. They're out near Geelong, near the town of Drysdale, eventually. And so there's also important information in these diaries about how forcing the land to become productive, agricultural, Western European-style farms was done. And a lot of these early diaries, not just this one, are really important from understanding how the environment's changed since settlement. And in addition to those diaries, though, I do have to mention one of the most striking things in our collection, that is the mourning brooch that Caroline Newcomb made for Anne after she died, after they'd lived together for, I think, over 10 years. And it's made out of gold and of strands of both their hair woven together.
There was something else going on. In other words, yes, exactly. That tells a lot. What I mean, speaking of which, Alan Taylor, do monarchs keep diaries which are accessible and able to be published?
Yes, they do.
Because I'm thinking of Queen Victoria and John Brown.
Yes. Yeah, well, Queen Victoria's diaries are very famous, and they were published, admittedly heavily expurgated. But we've been seeing from time to time unexpurgated versions of them coming out. But yeah, and the fact that Queen Victoria kept a diary again made diary keeping very popular. But women kept diaries right across the spectrum, from the likes of Queen Victoria through great authors like Virginia Woolf, all the way down to servants, Victorian servants like Hannah Cullick, who kept a sort of diary of her working day, which was quite incredible. If you tried to do what she did during a day, it was unbelievable that she managed to sort of stay awake for any time at all. There's always been a problem about what women kept records of. It only happened sort of rather sort of late in the day, and only in general among the educated class. Men seem much more sure of themselves and happy to sound off whenever they could. I think, though, what made diary keeping particularly popular among women, and especially among younger women, was the publication of Anne Frank's diaries, you know, that Anne Frank had... Yes.
Perhaps in a way the world's most famous diary in some ways, isn't it?
Well, yeah, in some ways it is, because, you know, it tells an incredible story of the Frank family fleeing the Nazis, going to Holland, and then living in concealment in a sealed-off back room, and then being discovered or being, given up to the Nazis, and Anne Frank and her family being taken off to Bergen-Belsen camp, where Anne died before her 16th birthday. And the discovery of the diaries and their publication had a phenomenal impact on people. In a way, it kind of gave people an insight into the Holocaust that they previously hadn't had, or they suddenly could relate to this young woman's plight. Mm. And they could see what a family was actually going through. It sort of personalized the whole thing. And the diaries sold in their millions, continue to sell in their millions, and continue to there continues to be a lot of speculation about them and about Anne Frank and her relationship to her family and the sort of difficulties post her death and post the publication of the diaries. And it did encourage, I think, a lot of younger women especially to keep diaries too. They weren't in the same situation, of course, as Anne Frank, but they felt that, you know, they were young people, they were teenagers, and it was as valid for them to keep a diary and to record their thoughts and happenings as much as it was Anne Frank's. I mean, a lot of Anne Frank's diaries not about the Nazis.
You know, exactly. Well, it's about awakening sexuality, amongst other things.
Yeah, yeah.
Isn't it?
Yes.
Which makes it... You say, in fact, that you put some entries, you include some entries, but not maybe as many as some might expect, because the work itself, the diary of Anne Frank, is better read as a whole than quoted from selectively.
It is. Yeah, it is better read as a whole, because it in a way it kind of reads like a novel. And I think Anne Frank, even at the age she was at, realised she wanted to be a writer. You know, it was a gift she had, and it was a gift she knew she had. And I think that Anne Frank, had she lived, would have gone on to become a great writer. The book, I think, is a great book anyway, but who knows what she might have done had she survived. But there was a definite realisation within herself that she was a writer, and that this might have been her apprentice work, her first novel or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Sophie says teenagers read Samuel Pepys for the casual sex. Well, yes, there is a fair bit of casual sex in Samuel Pepys's diary. That much is true. Greg, in Australia, there's a lot of significance placed on conflict diaries. I'll come back to you on this too, Alan, but libraries often make a big deal out of it when they add new diaries written during World War I or World War II. Why do you think they attract so much interest?
There's probably multiple layers to that, but I think that the first reason is the effect of the First World War, particularly Gallipoli, on Australia as a new country, only 14 years old by the time Gallipoli happened. And, you know, part of that can be said by some to be sort of a media-driven or a government-driven thing of the idea this is where Australia was born. But it did have a huge effect on the psyche of the country. So many people going off to war and, by you know, a lot not coming back. And the library's first real collecting of diaries actually happened after World War One. And interestingly, the directive was to preference diaries based around facts, figures, and not to look for stuff with too much commentary or people's thoughts or anything like that, which is definitely not what we'd be looking for now. But a little later, the 70s, that's when we got most of our World War One diaries. And a lot of that was started by the historian Patsy Adams Smith, who worked at the library. And at that time, it's the Vietnam War, and the World War One veterans who are still around actually told Patsy that they didn't think anyone wanted them, that no one would care. And she actually went on television to say, please, if you've got a diary, you know, the library would like to see them. And I think that started to bring the idea of the World War One diaries and other conflict diaries back into the consciousness.
I think that's right, isn't it? It was a generational thing. I remember helping Dad clean out the garage at one point later in his life when we discovered a box of stuff that was obviously his that belonged to my grandfather. And on sifting through it, I discovered that he'd been to Gallipoli. I said, Dad, did Granddad go to Gallipoli? And he said, oh, yeah. I had never heard this in my life. And it wasn't a thing, you know, for that generation. When I sifted through it, there in fact is a small diary. He was no writer, my grandfather, but in this small notebook, he does record some things at Gallipoli, including he writes a goodbye letter to a number of members of his family in it. I said, Dad, were you not interested in this? It did not have the same effect on him as I suppose it did for other generations. Alan, that's been true of British war diary keeping too, hasn't it?
Absolutely, without a doubt. I mean, the problem was for many people who were combatants, the instructions from was that you should not keep a diary, that it was dangerous to keep a diary lest it fall into enemy hands. But of course, people defied those orders and did keep diaries and secreted them. And they were writing them in part because they realized that any minute now it would be their end. Yeah. And this was them keeping a record, trying to tell people what was going on. And as Greg suggests, as you found from your grandfather, that this was sort of to let the folks back home know what was going on.
That they were here, they were alive, they were real, they existed at some point, because they probably didn't expect to be existing for much longer.
Well, exactly that. And war diaries tend always to have a sort of an upbeat kind of note to them, as letters home did. They didn't want to worry people. But they might send a letter home saying everything's great, we're having a fantastic time here, and the next minute they were dead. And so that is one aspect of the war diaries. But there are so many different kinds of war diaries, I guess. I mean, when we say war diaries, we think of people in trenches or on the front line fighting. But there are the people who are guiding the war, if you want to put it that way, keeping their diary, the people around in Britain, Churchill, and recording what was happening at the command centre day by day. And then there were the sort of domestic war diaries of the people who hadn't gone to war, who were at home, worried about their loved ones who were at war, but also keeping a record of what was going on what they called the home front. And there was an organisation in Britain in the Second World War called Mass Observation, which enlisted people at home to keep diaries. And they've been published too in various volumes. Mm. And they're incredible to read because they talk about how people dealt with rationing, blackouts, blitzes, missing people, loneliness, all sorts of things that kind of affect you when a country's at war. And I think they have a sort of validity as well as the ones where the soldiers were on the front.
Mm. You also extracted diary entries from some pretty, well, some people might think totally unsavoury characters, like Hermann Göring, for example.
And Goebbels, as well as
a key figure in Mussolini's fascist government, Count Galeazzo Ciano.
Give us a flavour of
some of those entries.
Well, I mean, Goebbels is a completely bizarre individual. You read his diaries and you think he's a crackpot, you know. I mean, he gives accounts of giving speeches to mass crowds, and he's basically like the warm-up act for Hitler. And he's sort of ramping up the crowd into a sort of fervour. And he says, oh, this all went very swimmingly. It was a great night. You know, they were cheering from the rafters. And then this Führer came on and everything went bananas. And he gave a half-hour speech and everything was going to be fine. The war was going to be won. And everything will be hunky-dory and the Reich will prevail. And then you look at the date and you realise, well, the war had taken a turn and the Reich wasn't going to prevail. And Ciano was there sort of recording Mussolini's meetings with Hitler and bolstering sort of Mussolini's gigantic ego. These are fantastic diaries, I think, because they give you an insight into something that you couldn't otherwise get from somebody, say, writing a history. They need the Cianos and they need the Goebbels of the world to give their histories the texture that's so essential. There's a lot of diarists who are despicable human beings. You might remember, some years back when it was said that Hitler's diaries had been discovered.
Oh, yes, the famous Hitler diaries, fiasco, yes.
Oh, it was one of the most egregious episodes in British journalism. When the Sunday Times discovered that they had Hitler's diaries, and they rushed into print with them, and of course they were all fabricated; they were all forgeries. These were not Hitler's diaries, but the very fact that the paper was so keen to publish them shows how desperate people were to find out what Hitler was thinking. How can we get into Hitler's mind? Well, the best way, surely, is to read his diaries. And you know, there was a terrible feeling of loss when these diaries were revealed to be forgeries. And you know, I from time to time think, oh well, wouldn't it be great to have the diaries of so and so, Jesus, Michelangelo, Bob Dylan? I would like to read these diaries.
Yes, we sure would. We sure would. As far as you're concerned, Greg, what do you think in terms of diaries is the most significant Australian one?
That's really hard for me to answer.
I know.
I can think of significance in different ways. And I'm really, in a lot of ways, I can speak most clearly for the Victorian collection, but there are ones that have huge significance that we don't hold. We have copies. The journals of George Augustus Robinson, who
rounded up the last of the Tasmanian Aborigines. Yeah.
Yes, he was not a good person.
No, he wasn't.
But in those diaries of incredibly, it'd be charitable to call them misguided deeds, there's information there that is of great importance to the present day Indigenous communities. There's, you know, names and language and all sorts of things. And so while reading them, it can be incredibly traumatic, the information that he recorded, however imperfectly and for whatever reasons of his own, is incredibly significant, I think.
Yeah, I think that's right. I read a book recently called Tongalongata about the leader of the Tasmanian rebellion, as it were, and that author used Robinson's journals a lot, not to get his perspective so much as, but because the history of those people has been lost into many people, and it is hard to piece together. You have to look behind the entries, as it were, to try and glean information. As you say, a lot of it is extraordinarily valuable, isn't it?
And I think Cassandra Pybus, and I have to confess I have not finished reading this book, but she seems to have managed with her biography of Truganini to use these sources without foregrounding or really mentioning Robinson at all. He's making it her story again, which is remarkable. He's not the only person for whom within the European story in Australia that there is also, from their perspective, information which is vital to from the Aboriginal story of Australia as well.
John, g'day. John from Wollongong. Hi, yes. John. Hi, John.
Yep. Good evening. Bit of a story here. I worked in Canberra for many, many years, and the company I was working for, we had to go and clean up homes when deceased estates and get them cleaned up and get ready. Yeah. And a number of this home especially had beautiful furniture. The person had died, single gentleman, and there was boxes and boxes of books and boxes of wine. And I was told to take the books to the markets. Well, I stored them in my garage because I was so busy. And this day I thought, I'd better get rid of them. I took them up to the markets, and this chap kept coming up and saying, this guy has been a spy. Where did you get him? I wouldn't answer it. So I brought the books home, and I said to my son, have a look at these books. There were some beautiful books, hand-painted Chinese books and things like that. And within these books, we opened one up. There was a section cut out, and this hand diary is in it. And it was written, now I can't give you it now because it's in my son's room at present, but I can give you brief information on it. The book was detailed around a war area, and he was writing about letting these people, helping these people escape from China. It was in the era of Mao Zedong.
Oh, yeah.
And he was a interpreter to Mao Zedong for the Australian government. Now, I found all this information out through a journalist who was looking into it, but then he finished off with it. But these books and that, what this chap had done, was helping these people escape out of China with this revolution.
What did you do with the diary, John?
My son has got it. Okay. We've got all the information here. It's all handwritten, some in pencil and things like that. Mm. And but it was so different. There was so many books you wouldn't believe. Winston Churchill's memoirs and things like that.
Yeah, well, the diary itself it would be immensely interesting, John. I suspect, and you might consider, you know, whether a library would want to acquire it. What do you say about that, Greg? I mean, are libraries keen to acquire diaries or some of them?
Absolutely, and I'd encourage. Like, we cannot take everything.
No,
but. It's better to err on asking us with a diary in particular, get in touch and let us know, because diaries are really one of the, I work with a lot of unpublished material. So, you know, letters, records, things like that, but diaries are incredibly popular just from, you know, researchers, journalists, family historians, and it's not, you don't, a lot of these diarists would never have known how popular, how useful, and how, I don't know, entertaining even they are to people, and how they've helped other people's lives. So I think we're always on, certainly the national and state libraries are always keen to hear from people and have a chance to think about whether we'd like a diary that somebody has.
Yes, exactly. Helen's on the line. Hi, Helen.
Hello.
Hi. Your niece found her grandfather's diary from the war.
Yes, he was an Englishman, and in the Second World War, he was a drum major.
Hmm.
He'd been in the First World War as a very young man, but then was had enlisted in the Second World War in England, and he was a drum major. He was actually a musician, and they were transported across to the continent, and they were captured by the Germans. And I think he went to 7 different concentration camps, but he was in Auschwitz IV. And all the time he wrote this tiny little diary in the smallest writing, and it was unbelievable. He hid it the whole time, and she found it in a box amongst all of his things. And she's written it into a book. It's the most magnificent book.
Mm.
It was published in paperback, but and now it was published in hardcover. Now it's been published in paperback.
Mm. Okay. Yes. Interesting. Just before we go, we should actually go with some. We should go with some diary entries too. I'm just reading Tony Benn's diary entry for the 2nd of December, 1958. Alan.
Yes.
about Lloyd George. Maybe it's not broadcastable. Do you think?
Yeah, I don't think so.
Lloyd George, he said, was a man of many parts. I know he was, said the old man, and he'll be remembered more for that part than any other. gave him giving a deep chuckle. I'll leave the rest to your imagination. Yeah. Do you think, Alan, that in this era of, you know, digital record keeping and so on, that handwriting generally is a dying art, I suspect. Is diary keeping a dying art, do you think?
No, I don't think so, actually. I think possibly this era might be a golden era for it. Mm. We're living through fairly tumultuous times at the moment, Phil, and I think possibly people have been keeping diaries, pandemic diaries, for example. Mm. I don't think the technology changes anything at all. In fact, it makes it easier to write diaries. People can maybe keep them shorter. They can make them tweet diaries if they want. But it's very easy to keep a diary on your iPad or your iPhone if you're traveling. It's write a few entries, make a record of what's happened to your day, just keep a check of details. You know, people start writing diaries in the oddest way, and then they sort of flourish. You know, they just keep a note of how much they've spent, where they've traveled, who they've met, and suddenly they add comments to this, and it develops. And I think that will happen and will go on happening. Mm. Letter writing's another matter, though. I think letter writing's gone.
Yes, that's true. I think we sometimes think, oh, well, the only value of a diary is if it was kept for a long time. Sometimes that's true, I think, as we discussed with the Jenkins diary with you, Greg. But other times it doesn't really matter, does it? I mean, Pepys's diary, for example, is only, I think, 9 years long, isn't it, Alan?
Yeah,
from 1660 to 1669, and yet yet the wealth of material that's in it.
Well, he thought he was going blind, and he stopped writing the diary. In fact, he wasn't going blind.
That's why he stopped. Yeah. What do you think, Greg? Do you think it's a golden time? Do you think we will get interesting diaries later on from the pandemic lockdowns in Victoria?
I really hope so. We've got a sketch diary that was donated to us, which was a wonderful thing to get through the pandemic period. I'd also be interested, and it's a little bit forgotten now, but the bushfires just before the pandemic struck, people's experience in those as well would be fascinating to read. And as Alan said, you know, an electronic diary is just as valid as a written diary, but it really does depend on whether it was written for the sake of writing or written for an audience. There's a bit of a difference. I think that people think that social media is taking over from diaries, but I really think that's, for a lot of people, almost a different genre. It's performative in a way that a lot of diaries aren't.
Yes, they can be. In the hands of great writers, of course, some of the entries are just marvellous, aren't they, Alan? I'm reading Evelyn Waugh's entry for 1919, 3rd of December. "We went for a house run to near a steep down today. No one could find the way. We stopped 100 yards too soon. A great white sea mist hung all over the downs and was wet on our bare chests. It seemed to heave and creep up the edges of the slopes. And Mr. Einstein has discovered a new theory of the universe." You can, in the hands of a great writer like Evelyn Waugh, these mundane things
fantastic.
Achieve great heights, don't they? They genuinely do. Yeah. Greg, is there a diary that you'd love to get? Is there a good diary of the Spanish flu in Australia, for example?
Well, I haven't had time to read one, but I'm sure we actually do have one, because we have the diaries of Dr. J.W. Springthorpe, who kept a diary throughout that period. But I haven't actually looked up those years yet. So it would be really interesting to see the medical opinion. But I just can't work out where he was when it hit, because he was serving as a military doctor during the First World War, and I can't immediately think when he got home.
I'd love to read them, because I suspect a lot of the arguments we're having today were the same arguments that they were having back then about treatments and ways to approach and lockdown or not lockdown and so on. And that's another joy of it, isn't it, Alan, that from the even down the long passage of time, you see that essentially the things that engage us as humans are always the same, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, you read Boccaccio's time in Florence during the great plagues and whatever, and it's very similar to today, you know, how people reacted. And that's one of the things about the diarists, is that you can see how similar humanity is over the ages. Of course, circumstances change, technologies change, television comes in, radio, etc., and all the rest of it. But the fact is that humankind, from one generation to another, has many similarities, more similarities than differences.
Exactly right. All right, well, it's been a pleasure talking with you, both of you gents, tonight. Alan Taylor's the editor of The Assassin's Cloak, an anthology of the world's greatest diarists. As I say, if you're looking for a Christmas present for someone who would love this, it's ideal. And Greg Duran's also been with us, too, from the State Library of Victoria. Gentlemen, thank you very much. May long may diary keeping survive. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.